Welcome to a different type of In Conversation podcast from the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM, where we will look at the paper, First 1,000 Days, Enough for Mothers but Not for Children, Long-Term Outcomes of an Early Intervention on Maternal Depressed Mood and Child Cognitive Development, follow-up of a randomised control trial, published in the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry, the JCPP. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology, and I have with me Professor Mark Tomlinson of the Department of Global Health, Institute for Life Course Health Research, Stellenbosch University in Stellenbosch, South Africa. Mark is the lead author of the paper we'll be discussing today. If you're a fan of our In Conversation series, please subscribe on your preferred streaming platform. Let us know how we did with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues. Hi, Mark. Thank you so much for joining me. Can you start with a brief introduction about yourself?
Thank you, Jo. Great to be here. I'm the co-director of the Institute for Life Course Health Research, which is based in the Department of Global Health at Stellenbosch University in Cape Town. And my research basically has, over the years, mostly been around child and adolescent mental health, tracking cohorts of children across time to track development, understand mechanisms, pathways of development. I always had a particular interest in maternal mental health as well as early child development.
And can you say what prompted your interest in, well, both young people's mental health, but in particular the impact of maternal depression on infant and child development?
I actually I had no intention of ever being a researcher when I was, you know, at university initially. My intention was to become a clinical psychologist, which I eventually did become a long and winding road. But initially, after my first 4 years of university, I went and I worked in a child and youth care agency, a residential child care setting where children had been removed from their caregivers, parents, for one reason or another. And that's really what sparked the interest in young children's development, how in some cases it goes off track, and what can be done to bring the, you know, development back on track.
Mark, let's turn to the paper. Can you set the scene for us? What did you look at and why?
This was a very interesting study in that we had completed an early intervention, a randomized controlled trial, some, you know, decade and a half prior to the study. And that study initially was funded by the Wellcome Trust. And then Grand Challenges Canada put out a call for a very interesting sort of set of studies of follow-up early intervention in the first 1,000 days. And they were now interested in tracking what happened to those children in terms of their cognitive development. There were lots of other things they were interested in, but cognitive development was their primary focus. And this was quite unique. People, you know, you tend to do a randomized controlled trial, you follow up a year later, and in most cases, that's where the study ends. And where there's some, but there's not enough, these long-term follow-up to understand whether early effects maintain, whether we can, you know, still see them down the line. And so we were successful. And we, with this funding, we were now able to follow them up in their early adolescence.
Can you say something about the methodology you used?
As I mentioned, the original study was an individual randomized controlled trial, fairly small. It was a total of 450 pregnant women initially, half in the intervention group, half in control. Mm-hmm. And then in this early adolescence, when we followed these children up, it was just trying to find as many of these caregivers and their children as we could. And where the original study had taken place, there's quite a high level of migration of people moving in and out back to the Eastern Cape, rural Eastern Cape, where many families come from, or to other parts of South Africa. And in fact, we hired a full-time recruiter who all they did basically for 18 months was track down participants, because we'd had no contact with them for close to a decade. And we found them in over 30, 35 towns all around South Africa. We basically, either if they're in Cape Town, we picked them up, or if they were elsewhere, we paid for the caregiver and the child to travel down to our research site in Khayelitsha, which is just outside of Cape Town.
And how successful were you in terms of recruiting?
Well, I think we were hugely successful. We managed to find just under 80% of the participants, which is quite remarkable given that when we started the study, there weren't even mobile phones. The contact details that we had for people in that 10-year time were often landlines. So before mobile phones were available, and so people had landlines, and even when they'd migrated to a mobile phone, because people in the sample, the caregivers were are very poor, they often shared phones, with other relatives who then, you know, then kept that phone and they were without a phone. And so it involved many, many reference points and phoning a neighbor, the neighbor knowing a friend, the friend knowing someone in Johannesburg. And so it was quite a lot of detective work, but we managed to get close to 80%, which we were very, very happy about.
Mark, what can you share of the findings?
We were very interested from the point of view of the funder that funded us in cognitive development. So that was the primary outcome that we were interested in from the point of view of the funders. But given that our early intervention had really been about focusing on the mother infant relationship, on mother-infant attachment, for example, we were quite interested in also looking at a whole range of emotional measures in terms of child development. And in the early trial that we'd done, we weren't focusing on maternal mental health or maternal depression at all. But at 6 months and again at 18 months, there was a signal that something was happened that was happening in that regard. Even though we didn't focus on it, there appeared to be a little bit less depression in the one group. It wasn't significant. So we made very little of it at the time, but we were also interested in following that up. So when we followed these children, their caregivers up at 13 years, we found that there were no differences in child cognitive development. So that early intervention didn't impact on cognitive development, which was, of course, disappointing. But having said that, it wasn't an intervention focusing specifically on the technical aspects, as it were, in terms of stimulation, for example, in terms of particular executive function tasks that you might include in an intervention if you were focusing on cognitive development. So it was disappointing, but it wasn't too much of a surprise. Where we were surprised was that, in fact, there was an effect, a very small one, which is important to say, on maternal mental health. So at age 13, which we found quite remarkable, that sort of, you know, 13 years after having received an intervention, that those caregivers who had received this intervention, focusing on them, of course, but them and their relationship with their infant, had an impact on their mood that long after. Now, it is also important to say we didn't diagnose maternal depression, for example. It wasn't a diagnosis, it was a screening tool. So it was, you know, women at risk of depression. But we were quite heartened by that, because we know from a wealth of research, both that we've done in South Africa, but in many other parts of the world, that maternal mental health is implicated in a number of difficulties in child and adolescent development, whether it's behavior, in some cases cognitive development. So it was heartening that this early intervention had some effect over a decade later.
I just want to go into that in a bit more detail. So the study finds no overall intervention effect on child cognitive development at follow-up when the children were 13, although in the paper it describes how caregivers who received the home visiting intervention during their pregnancies and postpartum did show lasting improvements in depressed mood. The intervention was also associated with mothers being more sensitive and less intrusive in their interactions with their infants, and to a higher rate of secure infant attachment at 18 months. So given this, how do you account for the lack of long-term developmental benefit for the children?
I think one of the reasons we called the paper the first, you know, it was around the first 1,000 days, is because there's been this very important focus in the last, probably, I suppose, 10 years on this period of the first 1,000 days. And it emerged because of very substantial, you know, research into how the brains of infants are just, you know, markedly growing. And, you know, and it's quite remarkable the rate of growth, the size of the growth of the brain and everything in those early years. And the importance then of this foundational period, these first 1,000 days. And with that has come a lot of absolutely fantastic things. There's much more of a focus on how early development is so important. And that then if you intervene early, you're setting up the foundations for later development. And it's absolutely foundational and it's absolutely vital. But one of the consequences of that focus has also been this idea that if you get it right early, that if you put all the right things in place, that then this has this amazing impact all the way through life. Mm-hmm. You know, and this has been supported by a very well-known study in Jamaica where they did a very early intervention, and they've been showing impacts of that intervention up to now. I think the latest study is looking at those children that received that early intervention in their 30s. So a real long-term follow-up. And there've been a couple of two or three also studies in the United States, which have shown how very early intervention does maintains this long-term benefit. But in my mind, in many of the studies we've done and a lot of other studies, is that that hasn't always proved to be the case, that you can have these very strong early effects, but that at some point they appear across the life of the child, the family, to disappear. And some people have called this fade out, that the results fade out. And there are many studies, in fact, even in the United States and Europe, where this fade out has also happened. And so trying to understand why is it that in some of these studies, the children seem to be doing markedly better, they have higher wages, less divorce, or, you know, 20 years down the line. And in other studies, by, you know, 2 years later or 5 years later, it appears as if all the benefits have now washed out and disappeared. One of the reasons why I think Grand Challenges was so visionary, in fact, in putting this funding together was I think they eventually funded 12 or 13 studies. And if you look at those studies, you'll see exactly what I'm saying. You'll find one study, for example, the very original kangaroo mother care study that was done in Colombia. They followed those original kangaroo mother babies up to when they were in their 20s. And they found some really important impacts still in 20 years' time. And then other studies that showed no effects. So trying to sort of now tease this apart, work out what it is, there are obviously many reasons for it. But one of the conversations I had with someone called Natalie Sharpock, she in fact was the one who led the kangaroo mother care study. She said that she thinks the reason for the long-term effects were less about the actual kangaroo mother care, although she said we obviously know that that was really important for infant survival and infant growth. But she said that what it did at the time was brought the family together, brought support systems together around the baby that was premature and extremely low birth weight, and that connections and bringing them together, that she said they could track over time and that maintained. And she said at the time, I remember when she was presenting her results, she felt that was the reason for the long-term growth, not necessarily the actual mechanics of the early intervention. Now, I don't think we have data for that, but I think her input, her thoughts on that are quite important. That's where we came in trying to understand some of the mechanisms of this. And again, remember that in any original randomized control trial or any follow-up, to some extent, all you're doing is you're analyzing the difference in the mean. You're always going to have, even an intervention group where it's benefiting, there's some families and children there who aren't benefiting at all, and some that are in fact benefiting much more. And so again, we also in the study looked at some genetic factors that may play a part in what's known as differential susceptibility. We also looked at, for example, cortisol in this very same, you know, in this Tulisana follow-up study. And so, for example, we found that even though there were no group differences in cortisol at the follow-up based on intervention or not, we found that you could quite reliably predict cortisol in these children at age 13 when they were put in a stressful situation like a laboratory task where they had to give an unexpected presentation to a whole lot of rather glum looking people in a doctor's coat. And we measured their cortisol and we found that we could predict the levels of children whose cortisol levels didn't return to baseline as quickly as others by how sensitive their mothers had been in interaction with them 10 years before. The picture is a very complicated one. We definitely don't have anything close to all the answers, but there's something about certain groups of children which seem to really benefit from an intervention, others that seem not to, that some the benefits disappear very quickly and others not. So that really is the sort of the real thinking behind the study.
The mothers appear to benefit though, because in the paper you state that the improvements in maternal mood are important. Can you say something about that? Why is that important?
As I say, maternal depression had never been the specific focus. We'd done epidemiological work in the same community and we'd shown that the rates of depression, and at that time it was in fact a diagnosis of depression, were very high. And it's a context of very high levels of poverty, of violence, of adversity. Many of the women are single, the father isn't around in many, many cases. We know the role that maternal care in those contexts plays in initially, even to the point of obviously infant survival, but after that in terms of child development. And a caregiver that is struggling with mental health difficulties tends to, and again, this is a gross simplification, but there's sort of two ways. There's a kind of a bit of a withdrawal, a remoteness that can happen, which is what one would sort of in a common sense way imagine happens in depression, that they become remote from the child. But another way is that they become overly intrusive, don't allow the child its own space. And we know that that can have, if it's, again, one episode that's dealt with well, where the caregiver gets support and treatment if necessary, the impact on the child can be minimal. But if it's chronic, if there are many episodes, that does have important implications for child development. So we would know, we know, again, from studies, you know, throughout the world, that children of depressed caregivers are, I should have perhaps said this at the beginning, all the participants in this study were the mothers, but the same is true for fathers. And so that's why I sometimes slip into a caregiver's, that, you know, you could be cared for by your grandmother, it's not your biological mother, but if she's depressed, it's equally not optimal for the infant. And so trying to understand impacts of maternal mental health difficulties across time has been a particular interest of mine. And in fact, we have another cohort of children we've been following for about 8 to 10 years now. And we've also shown there that basically one episode, you know, say, for example, of maternal mental health struggles when the child's age 2, for example, can have an impact, but it's you know, much worse. It is more episodes, chronic episodes, you know, and that can have implications from child growth to, as I said, cognitive development. And then as you move into adolescence, and that's why we're also quite interested with this particular group of children, because they were in their early adolescence, is that if there's maternal mental health difficulties, then that can have implications for children then, obviously, as they move into high school, but equally in terms of peer relationships, of getting involved with substances, potentially getting involved with gangs. I'm not saying that a caregiver with a mental health difficulty is causing a child to end up in a gang. Much more complicated than that. But in context of adversity, when there's lots of adversities, what we try and do, obviously, is to what extent can we reduce the number of adversities? Because that, we know, can then also, you know, assist the child as it goes through its life.
And this impact later in adolescence, is this related to fade out of early intervention? Because if I've understood it correctly, early intervention does benefit the mother. Her maternal mood changes, she might become less intrusive, she might become more attuned to her child in that early period. And yet the long-term developmental benefit for the child, that might not translate into that. So do you mind returning to the concept of fade out? Why does it happen? And more to the point, what could be done about it?
Right. I mean, that's a spot on question. I think the most important point for me of the paper is to say is that in conditions of high adversity, you must intervene as early as possible. That's a given. We know that there are lots of impacts of those early interventions. If they are of sufficient length, are of sufficient quality, we know they can have massive benefits for both the caregiver and for the child. But the mistake that often is made is that then, in a way, now because you've got the foundations right, somehow the rest of the house, to use a rather overused, you know, metaphor, is now going to build itself. Sure. It's not. Mm-hmm. And that although in some context it might be, there might be a family that is struggling at a point early on. They get the support from a community health worker who goes in. It's revelatory for them at the time. They connect with other support mechanisms. And actually their child now and themselves in their relationships with the child and with others, it's now sort of, in a way, just put it back on the right track, and we can leave them to thrive, as it were. Mm-hmm. But in context of adversity, for many children, early is not enough. And that's mm-hmm. the most important point, is if you imagine that you can just do that and now you've done your job, and that a lot of families aren't going to need more intervention across the life course, then you're making a big mistake. Because then, in a sense, you're having the short-term benefits. But if there's no long-term benefit, is that really worth it? I mean, I don't know an answer for that. It might be. But in fact, what we need to do is we need to work out in a better way which families, in fact, need to be targeted. There's a sort of a famous, well-known public health triangle of sort of what we would call universal approaches, targeted approaches, and indicated approaches. And the idea of universal is that Everybody needs that. It doesn't matter who you are. If you in the in London right now and you're pregnant, you go to antenatal care. Every pregnant woman goes to antenatal care. That is a universal service. We know it's a universal good and everyone gets it. In contexts where they're low resources, such as ours or many, many even poorer countries in Africa and elsewhere, is, you know, that there may be universal services such as antenatal care. But then the few resources are, in a way, we often try to give them to as many people as possible, obviously, because the need is so high. And a slightly different take, and again, this doesn't mean I'm saying deprive some people from that, but let's determine what's universal. So in our case, this early intervention of community health workers visiting women at home for the first in few visits in pregnancy and the first 6 months of life is a good thing, and everyone should get that. The question now is, can we then work out in the course of that which families now are going to need something in a year's time? Which ones will need, because of availability of caregiver or things, will they need a very particular kind of preschool to go to? The kinds of things that would probably happen routinely in many high-income countries where children are assessed continually in an ongoing way, they work out what they need, they get sent for remediation. So we need better to work out which families need a little bit more, and then which families in fact need a whole lot more. That for me is my main conclusion from that paper, is that if we just stop at 18 months or stop intervening at 6 months, you may have a very small effect on maternal mental health down the line, but you're not substantively impacting child development. Whereas I would propose that had we then had the resources to then deliver, for example, when those children, because we did stop when they were 6 months, so they were still babies, but when they were, say, 16 months or so, we've done a lot of very successful work on shared reading, also in a group context, using shared reading with caregivers and their 16-month-old. So if you have this early intervention, and then you build on that at preschool, then you make sure they go to when they go to grade R, the reception year in South Africa, that they're getting stimulation. If you build those on top of that early foundation, then you're likely to be able to, you know, avoid that fade out and that wash out of impact.
So there's something about continuous intervention and how it's targeted. But because it strikes me that one could look at the outcomes highlighted in your study and conclude that there is little benefit to funding early intervention programs of the sort described. And I would imagine that that is not the conclusion that you want people to draw. So Mark, what message should professionals, researchers, and policymakers take from your findings?
Firstly, and thank you for putting it like that, because that's, yes, absolutely not the conclusion, that somehow now we must stop investing in early intervention, because that's, you know, absolutely what we were able to show is that even in a context of such adversity, we were able to really change some, you know, really important factors such as attachment, which we know has implications down the line, mother-infant responsive caregiving. So we did have impact. So the early intervention is important. What we're always trying to do, I suppose, in any interventions, we're trying to create an enabling environment that allows children and caregivers and families to meet their potential. And no one thing, I would contend, makes children meet their potential. And anyone who's, even if you're living in a high-income country, knows that it's not one thing that's successful, because there's lots of bumps and traumas along the way, and it's a whole series of things, stability, good schools across a life course that really contribute to optimal development. So for example, if I go back and I think of that Jamaica study that had such good impacts, and in a similar context to South Africa, but one of the things, for example, in Jamaica at the time, and I don't know the exact figure, but, you know, they have near universal preschool education. So children receive that early intervention. Most of them would have ended up going through preschool. In our context, you know, sometimes, less than 50% of children will go to preschool. And so, again, one could argue it doesn't necessarily have to be a separate intervention, you know, like somehow us going to community health workers and delivering another intervention. It's just making sure that the institutions, the services that come later in the child's life are optimal, are of good quality, and that they can then build on that early benefit from early intervention. So that'd be my main conclusion. I mean, the other word that we need much more research on, and I know every researcher says that at the end of every paper, you know, more research is needed, I know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we don't know enough about the mechanisms of this across time, about why is it that some families and some caregivers seem to benefit so much from interventions and others seem to benefit perhaps a little, but not really very much, and others not at all. What are the factors? And to try and understand those across time, because one of the problems we have is that so many of the studies that we do, early intervention studies, if you're lucky, you get funded to 12 months, to follow up 12 months post the intervention. Tracking across time is incredibly expensive and time consuming. And funders, on the whole, aren't interested in that kind of investment across that period of time when they're not quite sure even what the result's going to be. So we need more funding of what's called longitudinal intervention cohorts, because we've got, the UK, I mean, you're the leader in the world on cohort studies, birth cohort studies. You've got more than anybody, and well-funded, and the government has funded those since post-World War II. Massive knowledge about child development has come from those cohorts. But one of the limitations of those is that there wasn't intervention. It's just tracking development, and that is important. We need some of those where you have a very big intervention, big numbers of an intervention, and then perhaps re-randomize along the way and target families and give them a different kind of intervention later and see what happens across time.
We're talking about the need for more research. Are you planning some follow-up research that you can reveal to us?
Yes, well, actually, with this study, we were also with the same cohort, lucky enough a couple of years ago to get some funding to follow up the cohort again at age 17 years old. So at the moment, we're in the process of I don't have any results as yet, but we managed to then be funded for another follow-up. So sort of watch the space, and we'll be able to hopefully give, more data around, for example, does the impact of maternal mental health maintain, for example, or there is another interesting aspect to some of these longitudinal intervention studies. And there was quite a well-known study many, many years ago, an early nutrition study, I think it was in Guatemala, where they found very strong early impacts because of their nutritional intervention. When they followed those children and caregivers up at age 15, I think, all the benefits had disappeared. And then they managed to get funding at age 25. And what had happened, and this is another term that gets used, it's called like there's fade out and there's something called resurrection, where all of a sudden the early benefits seem to like reemerge much later. Maybe that'll happen and that would be lovely. But again, just trying to understand the complexities of these pathways and whether it's fade out, it's resurrection or findings all the way along the line. It does feel like it's an important agenda to further.
It'd be great to see how it pans out. Mark, is there anything else in the pipeline for you that you'd like to mention?
I mean, as you've probably gathered from what I've been saying, I'm the co-director of the Institute for Life Course Health Research. We're really trying to understand, the complexities of these pathways, and so we also in this other cohort I mentioned, we're trying to, we've just submitted a grant again to follow them up when they're age 12 and 14, and to try and understand how potentially sort of the massive early adversities of these children and their lives could potentially, if you follow them into early adolescence, we know that adolescence is often quite an important second chance where if caregivers are able to be with their children in their relationship and monitor them and be responsive and not engage in harsh discipline, that can actually improve the resilience of those children quite enormously, even if you weren't seeing that very early on. And so we're trying to, get some funding to have a look at that in another sample. So again, just to try and understand some of the complexities of these pathways.
Really interesting and potential cause for optimism.
Yes.
Mark, finally, what's your takeaway message for those listening to our conversation today?
I think it probably goes, it's from one of your previous questions, is that early intervention is an absolutely necessary condition, but it's not a sufficient one. And we need to think about what we need to do later to build on what we achieve early.
Brilliant. Mark, thank you so much. For more details on Professor Mark Tomlinson, please visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H. And don't forget to follow us on your preferred streaming platform. Let us know if you enjoy the podcast with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues.